This week on Making Contact.
Anytime anyone says anything about Palestine, you get called a self-hating Jew, you get called a traitor, all these things.
As American Jews, we are the ones who have access, and we are the ones who have the potential to catalyze a transformation in Israeli culture and belief systems.
The American consensus on Israel and Palestine is breaking down, and Jewish Americans are playing a major role. But it's not easy.
If the debates that are going on now inside the Jewish community remain as toxic as they are, there's going to be a drop-off of involvement in younger Jews.
On this edition, a Jewish American community divided. More and more members of the tribe are breaking a long-standing taboo and voicing criticism of the Israeli government. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
One, two, three. Caterpillar, you're a killer. You're foremost fear instiller.
It's a warm winter's day in San Francisco's financial district. As businessmen scurry about, a small group of people are holding signs and singing songs about a boycott.
My name is Kayla Starr, and I'm a Jewish woman who's concerned about the treatment that the Israeli government is using against the Palestinians, killing them, jailing them, walling them off, destroying their houses. And so I'm part of an international campaign to divest from Israel, to put economic pressure on Israel to change its policies.
This protest is being held outside the offices of retirement investment firm TIAA Cref. One of TIAA Cref's investments is the Caterpillar Company, the makers of construction equipment. And according to protester Alexi Folger, that's not all.
They make D9 mechanized, weaponized bulldozers. The only customer for those bulldozers is the Israeli army. They do one thing. They're not construction equipment, they're destruction equipment. They're used to destroy Palestinian homes, uproot olive trees, which is an important economic resource. And they have injured and killed civilians, including an American, Rachel Corey, who was run over by a Caterpillar D9 bulldozer while trying to defend a Palestinian home from destruction.
Bulldozer, dozer, dozer, I smash your house to clay, and when I'm good and ready.
This action is part of a growing nationwide campaign, which is referred to in shorthand as BDS. It stands for Boycotting, Divesting, and Sanctioning both the State of Israel and companies that play some role in the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land.
So boycott, 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 join the rising tide for our sisters and our brothers.
The BDS campaign has targeted a few big companies, including Motorola, Northrop Grumman, and Caterpillar, which aid in constructing Jewish settlements or the Separation Wall, among other Israeli government initiatives. Activist Joel Frankquist has several thousand dollars invested with TIAA Cref in a retirement fund from a previous job. He says he thinks the campaign has a chance because TIAA Cref prides itself on being socially responsible.
They divested from Darfur, and so we see ourselves as just asking them to do a similar thing, to include the Israel-Palestine conflict.
TIAA Cref hasn't budged so far, but the BDS campaign is gaining steam. Students at more than 17 universities across the U.S. have raised the issue of divestment with their administration or student government. Some musicians and filmmakers have refused to perform in Israel. Most telling, in July 2011, the Israeli government passed a law making it illegal for anyone in the country to publicly call for a boycott of Israel. One possible reason for the success, a major component of the campaign, has been the participation of Jews, and in particular, a group called Jewish Voice for Peace, which organized today's protest. Frankquist is a member.
It is true, fortunately or unfortunately, that as a Jew, people may pay more attention to my opinion on this issue than if I weren't.
Changing public opinion and government policy has brought American Jewish activists into a head-on collision with one of the most powerful lobbying groups in the United States, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, generally referred to as AIPAC, has been the guiding voice for Congress on the issue for nearly as long as Israel has been a state. But in 2008, a new voice emerged, calling themselves J Street. The group started with 3 employees, and from laptops at their kitchen tables, J Street has grown to 50 staffers and 175,000 members across the country. They are, by their own definition, pro-Israel, just like AIPAC. But just what pro-Israel means varies widely. From Washington, D.C., Emily Friedman brings us the story of one of the most divisive Jewish groups in America.
There's been a war on since J Street was founded in 2008 to define it.
This is Ron Campius.
I'm the Washington bureau chief for JTA, the Jewish Telegraphic Agency.
He covers Jewish lobbying groups for the JTA, which until recently mostly meant he covered AIPAC. But now there's a new kid on the block with no lack of material to write about.
J Street is controversial because there was a perceived consensus on Israel within the Jewish community, and that consensus was defined by AIPAC, and that was whatever AIPAC was advocating that day or that year. What they say they're trying to do is create space in Congress not to take the AIPAC line.
But Campius says there's a big difference between how J Street sees itself and how many others see it.
J Street wants to define itself as a pro-peace, pro-Israel group. It's a pro-Israel group that is ready to criticize Israel when it doesn't feel it's doing enough to advance the peace process, and also criticize the Palestinians, criticize whatever U.S. administration is in power. The way it's been defined by others, by its rivals, is that it is anti-Israel, because there are groups who say to be pro-Israel, you have to be pro-government of the day, and J Street obviously doesn't feel it has to be pro-Israeli government of the day.
According to Campius, AIPAC and other conservative groups say no matter who's in power, Jews around the world should support whatever Israel does. J Street disagrees.
You can't be supportive of every action taken by every Israeli government because they change. Sometimes they're more left-wing, sometimes they're more right-wing. And to claim you should somehow support whatever it is Israel is doing isn't realistic. It doesn't make any sense.
Hadar Suskin is J Street's vice president for strategy and policy.
The message that we've been fed is basically that the role of the American Jews is to be supportive. Period, end of sentence. There's no definition of what that means.
Suskin says J Street defines supportive as doing whatever it takes to encourage a peaceful two-state solution.
We strongly support the state of Israel as a Jewish homeland. We strongly support the people of Israel. We don't support every policy and every action of every government. And neither does anybody else. The only question is whether people are willing to say so.
One of those upset with J Street's strategy is Alan Elsner, communications director for the Israel Project, which provides expert information on Israel to the media. He says the role of a pro-Israel organization should be to build Israel up, not criticize it. He says there are plenty of other people doing that already.
There are a lot of people who spend their days and their nights thinking of ways to tear down Israel, delegitimize Israel in the eyes of the world. There's an operation, actually. We're sitting in K Street in Washington, D.C. One block from here is an Iranian government-run, government-financed TV program with slick production values, which is devoted 24/7 to tearing down Israel. It is our duty to not let their lies, their distortions go unanswered.
There are other Jewish organizations that take a critical or nuanced view on U.S. policy toward Israel. But J Street is singled out, Suskin says, because of their work on Capitol Hill.
Much of the criticism of J Street, you know, centers around, well, we should have these conversations quietly within the Jewish community. It's okay for us to disagree, but you can't say that publicly.
And that word, publicly, is really a code word meaning in U.S. Congress. During the 2010 election cycle, J Street's Political Action Committee raised and donated funds to 61 candidates. They employ a team of 7 lobbyists who push for what J Street thinks is the best path toward peace in Israel. But according to JTA's Ron Campius, all of their lobbying efforts have not come without consequences. In 2010, when Israel set up a blockade around the Gaza Strip, J Street helped organize a letter signed by 54 members of Congress.
The letter really, you know, made a good faith attempt to be balanced. It talked about the rockets that Hamas had launched from Gaza into Israel. It talked about Israel's blockade being necessary for security reasons, but it suggested that Israel was going too far in its blockade and it needed to lift the blockade for humanitarian reasons. So this gave the opportunity to Republicans to paint this letter as attacking Israel's security, even though it explicitly said Israel had a right to defend itself. And the whole nuance of the letter got lost in the rumble. And the people who signed this letter have become known as the Gaza 54. They've been tarred as wanting to undercut Israel's security.
California Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey was one of the so-called Gaza 54.
J Street was a need waiting to be filled for many members of the Congress, like myself. For a long time, I've been one of just a few voices willing to not vote for a resolution that's coming out of the AIPAC corner if I thought that the resolution was unbalanced. Many resolutions I support, but if it's 100% pro-Israel and one or more so against the Palestinians, I'm not voting for that.
Woolsey received $11,800 in donations from J Street and its members. She says her constituents favor both J Street and AIPAC, so she maintains a close relationship with AIPAC as well.
So now what I see with J Street is help in looking at maybe the bigger picture. And it is more nuanced than the AIPAC members, but I find that to be their value. Really believing Israel will never be secure without working things out with the Palestinians.
And it's that so-called nuance that sparks opposition to J Street's positions and lobbying efforts. Here's J Street's Hadar Suskind.
People who are involved themselves very directly in more conservative Jewish organizations say to me, you know, members of Congress are really busy and you just have to tell them what to think about this. And you guys are confusing them by making them think it's okay to have a different view on Israel. Acting toward them in some sort of condescending fashion, like we have to just feed them the sound bites and make sure they don't get confused, it's not only insulting to them, I think it's insulting to everybody who works on this, and it certainly doesn't help achieve the goal. Our goal is very clear, it's to end the conflict.
I asked Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey if she thought criticism from American Jews could put Israel in danger. Her answer was clear.
Well, poopy on that. I mean, that's ridiculous. There's two parties here that have to work something out. Neither one of them is perfect. And if one of the parties thinks they're perfect, well, then nothing can be worked out. They both have to work together.
Apart from lobbying, J Street also has a grassroots branch with chapters in more than 50 U.S. cities and counting. They also continue to add staff members and new supporters. JTA's Ron Campius says J Street may become the go-to organizers for those Jewish Americans who feel misrepresented or not represented at all.
They're not necessarily a majority in the congregation. They might be a vocal minority, but they're there, and they need a voice, and they need a tent in which to express that voice. You're not going to get it at AIPAC. You're not going to get it at the traditional Jewish organizations. J Street is giving them that space.
For Making Contact, I'm Emily Friedman in Washington, D.C.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. We now return to Not My Zion, American Jews Divided on Israel and Palestine.
My name's Matt. And Worcester, Massachusetts.
My name is Julie.
My name is Mark.
A group of about 20 people are sitting in a circle introducing themselves in a basement room near Wayne State University in Detroit. This three-day conference is the first one ever organized by the Jewish Anti-Zionist Network.
Now we're going to talk about the goals for this workshop and tensions.
Most of the 200 or so people here are young Americans, with a sprinkling of internationals. Oberlin College student Elizabeth Weinstein is one of many here who say their religion and their entire culture has been hijacked by an ideology that they don't share.
I think it's really, really ingrained in a way that you can criticize what Israel's doing, but I think it's really frowned upon as a Jew to be anti-Zionist, because suddenly that's dangerous to something we worked really hard to fight and something we worked really hard to make for ourselves. And I think that's a really dangerous assumption, and I think that being at a conference that is explicitly anti-Zionist is exhilarating for me.
The term anti-Zionist is kind of hard to define. But loosely, it means everyone here opposes the idea that Israel should exclusively belong to Jews, and specifically, they don't support ill treatment of Palestinians in the name of creating that Zionist homeland in Israel. Some people here are religious, some not at all. Most say this is the first time they've had a safe but public space to express their views.
The first line of attack against people when they discuss Palestine is that they're anti-Semitic. So we're here saying it doesn't.
Conference organizer Greg Hamm works with the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network.
People who are in Jewish community are intimidated by mainstream Jewish community to not say these kind of things. And anytime anyone says anything about Palestine, you get called a self-hating Jew, you get called a traitor.
This is a joint struggle. I think this is a struggle that belongs both to the Jews and to the Palestinians. The Palestinians are the one who are getting the sharp end of the stick.
Mark Treyas moved from Russia to Israel when he was 5, then came to the U.S. 5 years ago at age 21.
The only people who can physically end the occupation, who can physically decolonize Palestine, are the Jews in Palestine or in Israel. And I think that as American Jews, we are the ones who have access, and we are the ones who have the potential to catalyze a transformation in Israeli culture and belief systems. And that's why I think that the first step probably lies here in the diaspora, in a mass Jewish movement that can infect the Israeli Jews.
The young people at this anti-Zionism conference are by all accounts a small minority, but their very existence indicates a growing disenchantment with Israel, particularly among young Jews. Well aware of the need to shape the perspectives of future generations, the Israeli government, along with Jewish foundations and philanthropists, teamed up in 1999 to create what's called the Birthright Program. Any Jew under 27 years of age can sign up for an all-expense-paid 10-day trip to Israel. More than 250,000 people have taken part in Birthright, which includes tours of holy and historical sites, discussions on the history of Israel and the Jews, and lots of partying. Birthright has been criticized for its one-sided history lessons, which some call propaganda. In 2010, journalist Kiera Feldman brought her audio recorder along on her Birthright experience. Here are some excerpts from a piece she produced for WBAI Radio's Beyond the Pale.
Here's what Benjamin Netanyahu wants to tell young Jews about Birthright. If you come to Israel,
you'll discover who you are, you'll discover your connection to the land of your fathers, you'll discover that in many ways, you've come home. Welcome home.
That's from a 2010 video. According to Brandeis researchers, almost 3/4 of alumni describe Birthright as life-changing.
Israel really changed me.
That's Julie Feldman. She went on Birthright in December 2008.
And I know that that also sounds probably trite, and many people have that response, but I truly felt when I came back that I was a different person.
It seems almost unbelievable. Could a 10-day trip really shore up Jewish identity and loyalty to Israel? I had to see for myself. So, in February 2010, I packed a suitcase full of recording equipment and went on Birthright. I chose the same tour provider as Julie, Israel Experts. They advertise, quote, serious programs for serious people who want to have fun. By the end, nearly everyone said they felt more Jewish. Some initially advocated binationalism, but that changed.
Haven't Jews been through enough that we can't just have this little sliver of the world as a Jewish state? Don't we deserve it? Don't we? 22 countries surrounding Israel that are Arab nations.
And Abraham walks down, kind of shuffles on down.
That's Joe Perlov. He's the CEO of Israel Experts.
Walks up a little further to the city of Hebron and dies. Don't die. Just stand there a second.
Right now, Joe's leading an audience volunteer into the Promised Land. It's part of an activity he calls the Changing Map of the Middle East. We're spending the weekend on a kibbutz called Gevulot. It was the first military outpost in the Negev. We sit in a circle, and the Middle East is made out of tape on the floor. Joe's history lesson skips diaspora. Fast forward to Herzl, the Dreyfus Affair, the beginning of Zionist settlement in Palestine, the Holocaust, and Jewish victory in 1948. Joe picks audience volunteers to illustrate Israel's population after the war.
Kelsey is an Israeli Jew. an Israeli Jew. An Israeli Jew. Raquel is an Israeli Jew.
Jason.
Jason is an Israeli Arab.
On Birthright, we laugh at the ridiculous, the unimaginable. We laugh at non-Jews.
1967. This was a big moment. We just conquered.
That's the sound of Joe ripping up tape from the ground. Up comes the West Bank, Gaza, Sinai, and the Golan Heights. Then, for the Yom Kippur War, Joe puts the Sinai tape back down. And like that, history is over. The lesson is that we're part of the Jewish people, we're responsible for Israel, and we have to help change the map to bring about a two-state solution. That evening, we file into a period house decorated with a combat helmet, army radio, and black and white photos of women manning artillery. We learn the story of the Gevelot Kibbutz's 1943 founding in the participatory manner of all summer camp lessons. Skits with gratuitous cross-dressing. A 21-year-old Israeli soldier named Yossi Misrahi prances on stage with makeshift breasts. Yossi is goofy and adored by the entire group. He fought in last winter's attack on Gaza, and he shows his new American friends the so-called terrorist headbands he collected from the bodies of Palestinians he killed. We are 5 miles from Gaza. The evening activity ends with a round of sweet Bedouin tea. L'chaim, we cheer, raising our glasses. We are excused to the kibbutz bar. The guide tells us it's a happening place. The locals come from miles around. He says, even people in Gaza are coming to the checkpoint. Everyone laughs. I actually don't think people on the trip are monsters. Birthright is designed to bring about a kind of deadening of feeling, a deadening through overstimulation. It's hard to imagine anyone else's suffering when you're having the time of your life.
Those were some excerpts from Kiera Feldman's radio piece, How Birthright Israel Works Its Magic. You can find links to the full audio and accompanying article in The Nation magazine at our website, radioproject.org. That story is one of an increasing body of media being produced, exploring the question of Jewish identity and who gets to define what it is. A new full-length film which touches on Birthright, the boycott of Israel, J Street, and many of the topics we've addressed in this show is called Between Two Worlds. Here's a clip from the movie's trailer, and when we come back, we'll hear from the directors of the film.
Jews should have a religion, and they should have a national identity in the state of Israel. And if you ask me why, I would say Hitler would be one good reason.
The most dangerous thing about Holocaust, the most dangerous thing about being abused, is that what you're going to do is abuse others. You're going to lose a fundamental trust in the world. And because of that, you're going to go small, you're going to go tribal, and you're going to look at everybody, no matter what, through the prism that they are my enemy.
My uncle was killed by a suicide bomber while trying to aid a Palestinian girl in a bypass surgery.
Israeli soldiers ordered the doctor out of the ambulance because he was from Gaza. My cousin died in the ambulance before they could reach the hospital.
I served at checkpoints. I went on missions and watched as Palestinian gunmen held children as human shields. We are dealing. I'm not lying. I saw this.
The movie is called Between Two Worlds, and I'm joined now by the two directors of that film, which first hit the festival circuit in May of 2011, Alan Snitow and Deborah Kaufman. So let's start with those questions you addressed in the movie. They center around a struggle for Jewish identity, who can speak as a Jew, who can decide who's Jewish, or who can decide who is Jewish enough in some cases. How can you describe that struggle taking place right now, particularly for Jews in the United States?
Well, what we're trying to do in our film, Between Two Worlds, is ask the questions, not answer them. And what we feel is that this film really, by asking those taboo questions, allows people to take a step back and not answer them so quickly, but ruminate a little bit on them.
There's another aspect, which is even by raising these issues, you're calling into question the people who have now come to the fore, which sometimes we call the Jewish Tea Party, which are the sort of bullies and intimidators, people who actually think that if you disagree with their position, they're going to make trouble for you, that they are the ones who have the flame of what Jewish identity is, what Zionism is, what support for Israel and what being pro-Israel is, who define all of those things. And they've restricted those definitions to such an extent that there's now active censorship in the Jewish community or self-censorship. And by raising the issues, we then are saying no to that censorship, that in fact this is an arena of discussion and debate, always has been and must be in the future. If young Jews are going to identify with a community which has always been defined by debate and discussion.
And what about Birthright, which got a small mention in the film? Can you talk about Birthright and its role in shaping particularly the consciousness and identity of young Jewish people?
We think it's great for young people to go for 10 days and have a great time in Israel. But the fact that $500 million has been spent and that this has been bigger than bar and bat mitzvahs, there are more young people who've gone on Birthright in that generation that have been bar or bat mitzvahed. What we wanted to do was to raise some questions that one of the leading philanthropists involved has very definitely said that this is not about people becoming Israeli. He's an atheist himself. He wants people to marry other Jews and have Jewish children in a very traditional sort of tribal way. And we think that's a very problematic idea about what Jewish identity in a hybrid world is, in a world in which many young people are intermarried or crossing borders, and there's excitement about that, and Jewish identity can be recreated in those kinds of situations. And so Birthright has a very traditional, I'm going to step back and away from that kind of idea of engagement to circling the wagons, and we are going to be the Jewish people just ourselves by possession of the State of Israel. The other thing is, it's a little bit bankrupt, it seems to me, for American Jews to say that going to Israel is the way American Jews in the diaspora should establish our identity. There's something sad about that, I think, and very limiting.
After all the investigations you've done, where do you think this struggle for cultural identity and for who gets to define the cultural identity, where do you think it's headed?
I think if the debates that are going on now inside the Jewish community remain as toxic as they are, there's going to be a drop-off of involvement in younger Jews with the Jewish community and certainly with identification with Israel and the Middle East, because it's too painful. We need to figure out a way to have an open debate, to not destroy each other in the argument that we're having, to respect the past and traditions and try to understand how we got to where we are today, but be open to change and to new ideas. And I'm somewhat optimistic, actually. I see a lot of really interesting things happening, both politically with organizations like J Street, but also internally in the United States, organizations like Progressive Jewish Alliance that are doing social justice activism. So I think that it's a kind of an exciting time, even though it's a little bit scary.
Alan Snitow and Deborah Kaufman are the directors of the film Between Two Worlds. We will link to the movie's website on our website, radioproject.org. Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. You can hear extended-length interviews with some of the people featured in this show on our website, radioproject.org. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.